Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look into the multi-million dollar international Christmas music industry and asking, what is the recipe for a successful Christmas song? And why do the old tunes do the best? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and new perspectives from BBC journalists all around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katia Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 4th of December, these are our main stories. Israel tells tens of thousands of Palestinians to move further south as it presses ahead with its military operations in southern Gaza. The harrowing account of a Ukrainian soldier in the bridgehead on the eastern bank of the Dnipro River. And the rescue operation after a volcano eruption on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Also in this podcast, 30 years on, what happened to the hopes of South Africans when apartheid ended?
They will say, vote. We vote, but nothing happened to South Africa.
And why two giant pandas are taking an aeroplane from Scotland to China. But first, since the breakdown of the week-long truce between Israel and Hamas, the Israeli military is now concentrating its attacks on the southern Gaza Strip. Israel has ordered the evacuation of multiple areas around the city of Khan Yunis, which is a key focus of the renewed Israeli offensive. A surgeon at a hospital in the city of Khan Yunis told the BBC that it's been overwhelmed. Hundreds of thousands of people sought shelter in the city after fleeing fighting in the north, the focus of the initial phase of Israel's operations. Now they're being told to move again. Israel says it's been distributing maps online showing which areas are in danger of being attacked. Sarah Bashi is the programme director at Human Rights Watch. She says Israel is failing to protect civilians.
Telling people to flee when there's no safe place to go to, no safe way to get there, and in the case of yesterday and the day before, utter confusion and mistakes about where they're supposed to go, that is not an effective warning. The Israeli military put on social media QR codes inviting people who don't have electricity or internet to somehow scan a barcode to see where they're supposed to go. They later corrected the maps because they were wrong.
The Israeli military says it's targeting Hamas command centers, weapons stores and naval forces and was taking unprecedented measures to protect civilians in Gaza. Avi Hyman is spokesman for the Israeli government.
We don't want to see any civilian casualties on Israel's side. We don't want to see any civilian casualties on the Gazan side. But sadly, this is war and war is hell. And we are conducting this war in the most surgical possible way. And when the dust settles and the real numbers come out, you'll find that our army has acted in a way that is far more advanced in saving lives than any Western army ever.
Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more about the Israeli army moving its focus to places in the south of Gaza.
What we saw over the last couple of days was a switch towards the south is where the main focus of the ground offensive is moving. I mean, before the truce came into effect, it was the north, of course, that was the main area that Israel, first with airstrikes and then with its ground troops, was attacking Hamas targets. And we've sort of been getting the impression that the Israeli army believes that it's achieved what it can there, although there have still been a number of attacks in the past few days since the truce ended. There was one on the main refugee camp there, the Jabalia refugee camp, which is already in ruins, parts of it. You know, there hasn't been a complete let up. I will imagine that there will still be operations there. But as I say, the real focus now seems to be going down towards the south,
where there are many, many people struggling to feed themselves.
Yes, I mean, the issue from a Palestinian perspective, a perspective of aid agencies, is that at the start of the conflict, people were told to head south, that that's where they would be safer, that there would be zones there where they would be relatively safe, as safe as they can be in Gaza at the moment, from the airstrikes and then the ground offensive that Israel was carrying out. In practice, that hasn't quite been the case, even when the focus was on the north. But what we've been seeing, what we've been hearing in the last couple of days, is that ground forces are moving further south. We've been hearing from residents in the city of Khan Yunis that there are tanks, there are armoured personnel carriers that are just nearing the city there. So real concern for people, hundreds of thousands who left their homes in the north, some of whom returned during the truce, but now one assumes many of them have gone south again when the fighting started again, and where they can go. I mean, what the Israeli army has done, and, you know, we were hearing them from a military spokesman saying that it's doing everything it can to keep the civilians as protected as possible. And one of the things that Israel's been doing is setting up an interactive map which has divided Gaza up into many, many small zones. And the idea is that people in those zones will be informed by Israel when it's about to attack and they'll get a chance to evacuate. But there's all sorts of issues over that in terms of internet, in terms of the electricity supply, and simply in terms of the accuracy. And finally, you know, where they can go when they are evacuated from there. So, I mean, the issues are really redoubling again.
And new outbreaks of violence in the other Palestinian enclave, the West Bank.
Yes, I mean, there have been daily raids that we've seen long before the conflict between Hamas and Israel erupted back in October. I mean, that was really where the focus of the violence between Israel and the Palestinians had been for almost a year and a half. We've seen a much greater loss of life amongst Palestinians as Israel's been carrying out these military raids, many of them fighters, but some civilians too. Today, there were two Palestinians who were killed in Qalqilya as Israel mounted an operation there. So, I mean, as the situation in Gaza has heated up, there's been a similar, though not obviously on the same level, of an intensification of what was already underway in terms of violence in the occupied West Bank, and concerns growing all the time that that could get more and more out of control as the situation in Gaza possibly deteriorates further.
Sebastian Usher. Human rights organisations in the Netherlands, meanwhile, are demanding an immediate halt to the supply of weapons to Israel. Oxfam and the Dutch branch of Amnesty International are calling on the Dutch government to stop exporting F-35 fighter jet parts, which are made in the Netherlands, saying the current situation makes it complicit in war crimes. Anna Holligan in The Hague told us more about the case.
It's a really interesting test case, actually. These human rights organisations have brought a case against the Dutch state, essentially suing the Dutch state, accusing them of potentially being complicit in violations of international humanitarian law by allowing these exports of F-35 fighter jet spare parts from the Netherlands. And this is its European distribution centre of American F-35 spare parts to Israel. And this all kind of came to light because of a report in the NRC newspaper in which the journalists found that the exports were continuing despite the situation on the ground in Gaza. So these organisations brought the case to court saying, we want this to cease immediately. We want the judges to rule that this cannot continue. The government has said in parliamentary questions they're looking into the legality of these exports. We know they have the potential to intercept exports if those exports potentially violate Dutch foreign policy. But of course, there is the political situation, and any effort to stop American exports to Israel would be very difficult for the Dutch government. So that's one of the issues, according to reports in the NRC newspaper, which is creating this kind of delay.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. Last month, Ukraine claimed a symbolic victory in its fight back against the Russian invasion when its troops took ground on the eastern banks of the Dnipro River, a major front line in the war. A few hundred soldiers are continuing to dig in, and President Zelensky has been keen to talk up their modest gains. But they're outnumbered and outgunned, and one soldier who spent 6 weeks fighting there has told the BBC the operation is hell with no clear objective. His testimony has been voiced up by an actor.
I escaped from hell. Last time I got out after getting concussed from a mine, but one of my colleagues didn't make it. All that was left of him was his helmet. Every day we sat in the forest taking incoming fire. We were trapped. The roads and paths are all riddled with mines. The Russians control everything. Their drones are constantly buzzing in the air, ready to strike as soon as they see movement. Even getting there is difficult. The entire river crossing is under constant fire. I've seen boats with my comrades on board just disappear into the water after being hit. Lost forever to the Dnipro River. Supply is the weakest link. The Russians monitor our supply lines, so it's becoming more difficult. There's a real lack of drinking water, despite our deliveries by boat and drone. We paid for a lot of our own kit, buying generators, power banks, and warm clothes ourselves. Now the frosts are coming, things will only get worse. The real situation is being hushed up, so no one will change anything. When we arrived at the left bank, the enemy were waiting. Russians we managed to capture said their forces were tipped off about our landing. So when we got there, they knew exactly where to find us. They threw everything at us. Artillery, mortars and flamethrower systems. I thought I'd never get out. There was no progress. In a month and a half, we took a small bridgehead, which the officials passed off as a breakthrough, but there was no equipment because it couldn't be transported. So we only had people. And you won't make much progress with them. Nothing changed. We just sat there. No one knows the goals. Many believe that the command simply abandoned us. The guys believe that our presence had more political than military significance. But we just did our job and didn't get into strategy. The weather has a strong influence. Those of us who were more experienced managed to prepare and help the others to put themselves in order. There are a lot of young guys among us. We need people, but trained people, not the green ones we have there now. There are guys who had spent just 3 weeks in training. Everyone who wanted to volunteer for war came a long time ago. It's too hard now to tempt people with money. Now we're getting those who didn't manage to escape the draft. We just don't have enough men. I know guys who stayed for 10 days, but there are some who were there for a month-long stretch. If you're lucky and your commander is okay and cares about his people, if they survive, they're rotated out. But that's if the commander is a normal person. The guys who replaced us last time got into even more hell than us. My time to cross the river again is soon.
The testimony of a Ukrainian soldier on the front line. On Sunday, the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, arrived in the German capital, Berlin. He's there for the first bilateral top-level meetings in 8 years. The German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, has been on a quest to improve ties with the global south. Germany considers Brazil a key partner in its bid to diversify trade by reducing its reliance on China and plug a gap in skilled labour. Davina Gupta has been speaking to the political scientist Professor Guilherme Castelroesch, an expert in Brazilian foreign policy and international relations at the Sao Paulo School of Business.
Before Lula took office, the last official visit took place in 2015 when Chancellor Angela Merkel met with President Dilma Rousseff back then. She came to Brazil in mid-2015. Back then, besides trade and investments, the most important bilateral agenda related to environmental cooperation on both bilateral and multilateral levels. But after Rousseff's impeachment in 2016, but especially during the Bolsonaro administration, Brazil and Germany distanced themselves from one another. On Germany's part, there were increasing ideological differences between the ruling coalition and the SPD in particular, and the Brazilian administrations of Michel Temer, who's a right-wing politician, and Jair Bolsonaro, who's a far-right politician. On Brazil's part, a trade-oriented agenda drove the country away from multilateral cooperation issues such as human rights and climate change, leading to new priority partnerships such as the one with the United States, for example.
But with this visit, it's also significant for Germany to have relationship with Brazil. So tell us about the common interest areas that could be on the table, what it means for both the nations.
Well, it's actually the fourth time Lula and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz meet in 2023 alone. And this visit in particular is important, not just because Brazil and Germany are the largest economies in their respective regions, but also because they are close partners in urgent global issues like climate change and human rights. In the world that we live in today, which is becoming increasingly dangerous, these two countries are also committed to the Security Council reform, which is key to enable the United Nations to address ongoing conflicts in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. And that's the reason why Brazil-Germany partnership is so relevant for both countries, because they're working together on a number of different issues, and these issues are becoming more and more urgent with time.
You mentioned the continuing engagement between the German Chancellor and Lula da Silva, but there's also been a difference of opinion, because when it comes to, say, Russia-Ukraine war, Lula has not yet put sanctions on Russia. It's not agreed to supply weapons to Ukraine. So there will be these differences that will be discussed as well, one presumes.
Yes, I would say that in general, bilateral relations between Germany and Brazil are in a very good shape, especially if we compare the state of relations before 2023. We've seen so many troubles going around between Brazil and Germany, Bolsonaro and Merkel. They went head-to-head a few times on social media, for example. So relations are in a great shape, not just because Lula has expressed his desire to place Brazil back on the global stage, but also because both politicians are like-minded politicians with similar positions regarding the broader values of democracy, progressive ideas, and so on and so forth. So that's one very important aspect of the relationship.
Professor Guilherme Kessler-Roesch from the Sao Paulo School of Business. Still to come in this podcast, Spotify wants to cut the number of its employees by nearly a fifth.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
I believe in the curse. Yeah, I think it's real.
Is it just superstition? Or could there be more to it?
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
What do we need to do to win an All-Ireland final for Mayo?
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Katya Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look into the multi-million dollar international Christmas music industry and asking, what is the recipe for a successful Christmas song? And why do the old tunes do the best? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and new perspectives from BBC journalists all around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A rescue effort is underway after a deadly volcano erupted on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. 11 hikers have been found dead near the crater of the Merapi volcano after lava and ash spewed hundreds of metres into the air. There are fears for others still missing. Brigadier General Rayan Obersil is leading the rescue efforts.
The weather is not being friendly to us. As you can see, there's still fog around this area, not to mention all the ash that's also here. So these are the challenges that we're facing in this evacuation process.
Our correspondent Shaima Khalil is monitoring developments from Bangkok. I asked her for more details.
Well, we know that the three people who were found alive near the top of the volcano that's very close to the crater's rim, they've been rescued. Authorities have said that they were weak, that they had suffered multiple burns. We also know that the volcano erupted on Sunday, but remember, there were dozens of hikers and climbers that had made their way onto the slopes of Mount Merapi from Saturday. We know that dozens of them are still stuck there, but we also know that 49 have been evacuated earlier today, many of them also suffering burns. And it's just really, really dramatic scenes over there. Huge plumes of volcanic smoke rising as high as 3 kilometres. I was watching footage earlier from an ambulance that was on its way to the scene, driving through roads that were covered in ash, cars on either side covered in white dust. There were also some social media pictures that were shared of some of the climbers with their faces covered in that white dust of ash as well. Just to also speak about the search operation, you heard it there from the authorities. They are contending against really, really unstable and rough terrain. 12 are still missing, and we understand that the search for them has been suspended because of the weather, but also because of a smaller eruption that has happened.
And there are warnings that the volcano eruption may not be over yet.
That's right. And remember, this has been active since January and February. There was an eruption earlier this year, but it didn't result in any casualties. There has been a steady build-up to what we've seen on the weekend. Right now, the authorities have issued the second highest alert level. We know that 2 hiking routes have been closed. Also, about 1,400 people live on the slopes of Mount Merapi. They've been told not to get within 3 kilometres from the area as the search and rescue continues. But again, in very, very difficult and complicated circumstances.
Shaima Khalil. Spotify, the world's largest music streaming platform, says it will reduce the number of its employees by around 17%. The decision comes despite the company showing a profit in the third quarter following price increases, a growth in subscribers and a 6% cut in staff at the beginning of the year. Leanna Byrne asked Izzy Greenfield for more details.
In a memo sent to staff, CEO Daniel Ek said slowing economic growth and rising costs were to blame for the cuts, which he said would make Spotify a leaner company. Spotify employs about 9,000 people, and Mr. Ek said substantial action to right-size our costs was needed for the company to meet its objectives.
Now, some analysts are pointing to the fact that Spotify has invested heavily in podcasting. Has that actually had any impact on its financial performance?
Yeah, so Spotify has spent a lot of money on growing the business since it launched and on securing exclusive content, such as podcasts created by the likes of Michelle and Barack Obama, as well as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. The deal with Harry and Meghan cost a reported $25 million and saw just 12 episodes delivered over 2.5 years before the deal ended in June. Spotify's chief executive told the BBC in September that some podcast content has worked, but some of it hasn't.
Yes, very diplomatic there. Daniel Ek, the CEO, he says the company is taking steps to become more efficient. What are those steps, Izzy?
In its latest results, Spotify reported a profit of $65 million for the 3 months to September, its first quarterly profit for more than a year. Given these positive results, the job cuts might seem quite extreme, but the chief exec has decided that more drastic action is needed to improve the company's finances. Spotify has also been making moves to increase revenue, raising prices of several of its plans across multiple markets over the summer.
The BBC's Izzy Greenfield. 30 years ago, Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for peacefully ending the apartheid regime. It was just 4 months before Mr. Mandela's African National Congress won the first democratic elections, and he pledged that all South Africans could be children of paradise. But now, blamed for widespread corruption and failing public services, the ANC faces a major challenge in elections next year. Our special correspondent, Fergal Keane, has been back to South Africa to meet a family whose story he first reported in 1993.
I feel very ashamed. You can see yourself, I haven't got a place to sleep. I also sleep with the small children outside here. Because I'm suffering. I'm suffering because I'm black.
The voice of Cynthia Mtebe 30 years ago, when I first met her in a squatter camp at Tembisa on the stony veld between Johannesburg and Pretoria.
The future must change. We want to be the same like white people. We must be the same.
In 1993, Cynthia and her children lived under a plastic sheet held up by sticks. She buried it in daytime, fearing demolition by the authorities. But Cynthia had hope, and the first free elections the following year promised great change.
I can see black fists being raised in the air and people cheering this end of an old order, the end of the order of racial discrimination, of segregation, the end of the age of pain and humiliation.
30 years after witnessing the death of apartheid, I'm back in Tembisa.
So we're calling her, yeah?
Yeah, I'm calling you.
Okay, to get directions.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
I've arranged to meet Cynthia Mtebe's daughter, Doris, in a place notorious for violent crime, not helped by frequent power blackouts as critical infrastructure fails, and where unemployment is over 30%.
You know, life in South Africa, when I look at life, it's war. You have to be strong, life in South Africa. It's not easy.
The other big thing which we read about all the time is about corruption, eating away the money in government so that you have no services or very poor services.
Yeah, corruption is too much. Look at our street. There's no street lights. I'm telling you, this place is not a nice place to live.
Viva ANC, viva! Viva ANC!
Billions have been looted from public funds under ANC rule. With elections looming next year and party support slipping, the ANC often blames the legacy of apartheid inequality and argues that it's created a welfare system, built millions of houses, put many more children into education.
Yeah, I'm Frans Moko. I'm still leading in the structures of the ANC.
As a long-term ANC activist and representative in this township, do you feel ashamed of the corruption that your party has presided over?
Unfortunately, some of them, along the way, they resort to very bad things. Am I proud that they have happened? No, I'm not. Of course I'm not. We are taking very radical measures in addressing those things. And I'm not being arrogant, but let's check post the elections next year, because South Africans are a very understanding society.
I wondered what Cynthia Mtebe thought of all this, the woman whose struggle I witnessed 30 years ago in a squatter camp.
Mama Cynthia.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm still alive.
You're still alive. You're very alive. You're looking good.
Oh.
So lovely to see
you. Okay. Oh. My problem, I can't see again.
Yeah.
I'm blind.
But you're smiling.
I must smile.
In a rural area several hours drive north of Tembisa, Cynthia Mtebe lives now in a simple brick house built by her children.
Cynthia, when I first met you back in 1993, you were hoping for a country where you would be equal to the white people.
Yes.
Do you feel that you have, that you are equal now?
Never. No. People are suffering, Fegel. They will say, vote, 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 vote. We vote, but nothing happened to South Africa.
Why do you think things haven't worked?
As long as his pocket can fill up with money. Not you, other people. No.
Corruption, in other words.
Yeah. I'm old now, Fegel. 77 years. I just go to the church and pray every time. That's all.
Cynthia Mtebe ending that report by Fergal Keane in South Africa. Britain's only giant pandas, Tiantian and Yangguan, are on their way back to China after spending the last 12 years at Edinburgh Zoo in Scotland, where they've been on loan. Three other giant pandas also left the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C. last month to spend their dotage in China. Our Scotland correspondent Alex McKenzie reports.
A final farewell. Edinburgh Zoo has been home to the pandas for more than a decade. At the weekend, staff helped them to acclimatise to these crates, which will be used to help transport the animals back to China. Staff at the zoo became attached to the giant pandas and their very different personalities, and say their departure will be emotional. Some have looked after them since they arrived and will travel with them on their return plane journey.
It's been up and downs, there's been stressful times over the past 12 years, but we've all
taken to it in very good spirits. We've all had a great time doing it. I think it will be such a change to our lives, to our day, without them being here, and it will be definitely be sad and definitely get some getting used to kind of fitting into what our new normal is without them being here.
While in Scotland, there were 8 attempts at artificial insemination between the pair, but Yang Guan and Chen Chen return home having failed to produce a cub. Staff say they will be closely monitored while aboard the plane.
During the flight, I'm not expecting to have major challenges. Yang Guan and Tian Tian are healthy, so my plan is to feed them plenty of bamboo throughout the flight. I will monitor them very closely, of course, and they will also have one of their favourite keepers with them, so they should be happy.
The official handover of the two pandas will take place halfway between Scotland and China. A zookeeper will hand over the keys to the crates, officially ending their time at Edinburgh Zoo.
Alex McKenzie. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Mazetska, and the producer was Oliver Berlau. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look into the multi-million dollar international Christmas music industry and asking, what is the recipe for a successful Christmas song? And why do the old tunes do the best? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and new perspectives from BBC journalists all around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.